Well, then that's the story of reggae.
Slicing.
Oh, wait a minute. We got a show to do now.
Oh, okay. Hello, hello.
Hello, hello. Well, who are we?
I'm Don, and you are?
Dr. Morbius slash Al.
Or you should say Dr. Part Mobius from Parts Unknown.
From Parts Unknown, yeah, I forgot. Well, I usually have the Parts Unknown guy say that. In this case, I'll do it myself. And we're Two Dimension Comic Book Podcast. Comic Book Podcast with no direction.
There you go. Which, as you heard in the song that just came before.
Yeah, whatever great song that was. And we hope you liked it.
One thing I wanted to start off with, I had bought a book by Gene, I'm going to butcher this man's name, Gene Long Yang. And it was called American Born Chinese. I heard about it on another show years ago. It sounded interesting, so I bought it. It's a thick book, four color. I liked his art style, but basically, he was a Chinese-American. The book was called American Born Chinese, and it was three separate narratives, which when I was reading it, I thought, he's kind of jumping around. There's three separate stories that all coincide at the end. And he's talking about what it's like to be Chinese in America, and, you know, at the time, I guess it's in the 70s and 80s when he grew up. I really like the book. It won a National Book Award and something else. It's got two medals on the cover. I lent it to my daughter when she was in high school. She read it. And when it's finished, she goes, "The ending confused me." Well, it starts out telling stories about the Monkey King, which, you know,
there is a monkey character in there.
Yeah, that's the Monkey King. But, anyway, he's basically talking about racial stereotypes, you know, people's perceptions of things. And like I said, he's an American kid that just happens to be of Chinese blood with Chinese parents.
Right.
It's strong work. And again, I liked his art style. I looked him up online. And he's done some other comics, but I guess they were, I've never seen them in life. I didn't order them because they're, I guess, regular comic books. But one is, I guess, the story of Rosary Beads. He's Catholic, I take it. And but I guess he's basically wrote a story illustrating rosary beads, and I guess how you use them or why the history of them. I don't know exactly what it was, but there's a few things like that that he's written up in books that are important to him. I think he's a mathematics teacher in middle school or high school, which fascinates me. When I look at his artwork, I love it, but I can see where he is mathematics because he's using them. I can't think of perspective all the time. But, you know,
but it looks like kind of like manga.
Yeah, it has a manga style. It
it has that the Tezuka style, the guy that Astro Boy. And
yeah,
that.
And also Tintin. It reminds me a lot of Tintin. It's a really beautiful.
And it reminds me a little bit of Jaime Hernandez.
Jaime Hernandez.
Yeah, a little bit.
All People I Love. Like I said, Natural Born Chinese, I really did like. I think it's a nice book. It's nice to get. I've never read any of his other books because they just didn't seem like, you know, I have a lot of trouble to get off of his website. Well, I just walked in the store, and my daughter pointed out there was two books side by side. One was called Boxers, and one was called Saints. And it was by this you know, creator. One thing I do like is he has a graphic sensibility. The way he put the cover to American Born Chinese is really unique. Boxers and Saints, if you put them together, it makes one face.
Oh, yeah, look at
that. Not that one.
Oh, the other one. Okay, never mind.
In Boxers, the character's on the half of his head is on the left side of the book, and on Saints, a different character has his head on the right side of the book. You put them together, you're showing, you know, half of two Chinese men's face. Boxers is something I never quite knew about. He's talking about the Boxer Rebellion that happened, I guess, at the end of the 18th century or beginning of the 19th. And I've always heard about it. I've heard Hong Kong movies refer to it. There's a movie called 55 Days in Peking where they talk about the Boxer Rebellion. It's one of the, I guess, one of the last of the lavish movies that they put out. It's got, I think, Burt Lancaster and Ava Gardner in it. And the problem with that movie, it looks nice, but it just seems to me like it's kind of racist. How they portray the Chinese is kind of bad. So anyway, I bought Boxes, which is the thicker of the two books. I intended to buy Saints later, and then the guy at the store says, "Oh, well, you do know there's another one of these." I said, "Yeah, I'll get that another time." And he said he had two copies of each, and one guy bought the other two together. I guess he's put out, I was just buying one, and he's stuck with the other one.
Well, yeah, he's going to have a hard time selling it.
I am going to go get it later. I thought it was neat they came out at the same time, but the Boxer Rebellion is basically about China. The whole, his story starts out with a small farming village. You know, they're not rich. You know, they're just making it. And this one, kind of a seedy guy comes in and starts complaining about somebody's bread, buns or something. He buys it and says it's bad, and then or charging too much, and the woman selling them just takes it back and gives him his money, says they're not for sale, go away. Well, the guy comes back with a bunch of thugs and one European who's basically, he's a priest. He's got a cross, he's in the long robes. And they're talking about he had a long nose, which they'd never seen before. And he basically walked up and says, "Is this the woman that did it?" And then they took, They took produce from her, some of the food. And then after the priest gave it to the guy that caused all the trouble, the guy went to get more and said, "No, brother, this is enough for the rep, you know, this is enough. Just go away." Well, the people were just kind of horrified. And they had, I guess basically their patron saint, which is a ceramic statue that they brought out for the festival. Every year they took it out of the temple, put it out there, and the priest walked by and saw that, freaked out, said idolatry, picked it up and smashed it, which was something important to these people. And then they walked away, and that's where the Boxer Rebellion started. It was going all over China, and I guess basically the Europeans had strongholds, had armies there, which, you know, Jackie Chan and Jet Li movies always talk about it from time to time, about how Europeans were coming and stealing all their treasures and, you know, everything they had. But the whole story goes into the Boxer Rebellion, how the factions came and how the army came and how it all ended up in their main city. And even the Empress seemed to side with the Europeans, but at the same time she's with the Boxers. I don't really know why they're called the Boxers, but they had a long name that said something holding a sword. And then later it changed to standing with her fist or something like that, which I guess slang was Boxers. But the second book, Saints, I take it, is the
other side of the story.
Yeah, because that was one problem they had. They had Chinese, I can't remember what they called them, but they were basically Chinese Christians.
Yeah, it looks like it from just glancing. They saw a crucifix, a cross on one.
So some of the Chinese weren't traditional Chinese anymore. They were with the Europeans. So I guess he's telling their side of it. I really like stories where you get to see both sides of it, where it's just not one, which I'm used to seeing all the time. I kind of miss the days when the bad guys were just evil and the good guys were nothing but good, you know, but at the same time, I do like to see the good, you know, the perspective on each one, regardless if I agree with it or not. I do like this book quite a bit. I am going to get Saints reading it. It sounds to me like, I guess my only criticism of it is, it seems to me like he writes it as an all-ages book, which is fine, but it seems to me like he's speaking to the lowest level, which is small children. And I want a little bit more depth in him. At the same time, he does things. He decapitates people. He kills. But I still feel like he's speaking to smaller, you know, small children. But I find it amazing that he seemed like a fairly young guy. I'd say pretty accomplished if he's teaching kids all the time and putting out this much work. That's very impressive.
Was this originally released in comic book form, or was it always a graphic?
Not that I know of. I think it came out as a book. One thing my daughter talked about, she didn't quite understand, was that the book on American-born Chinese, it has a :01, and she thought that just meant the issue number or something. But it's the name of the book. It's called, the publishing company is called First Second.
I saw that, yeah.
And she says, oh, that's, when she saw the box, it was insane. She goes, oh, that's what it is. It's the publisher. But, again, it's strong work. It's work I like quite well. I do recommend it. It's out. I was happy I found a store. If you see one, Americans born Chinese, I see everywhere, you know, in bookstores and stuff like that. It is a strong work, and it's, he addresses a lot of issues that happens, and not being a Chinese growing up in America, it's things I never saw. But I found it interesting. Boxes is quite good. I'm going to get Saints. I didn't like it as much, but it's still strong work.
Good. Yeah, they look like nice books. I mean, I've never heard of the guy before. It isn't, I don't think he's done, that I know of, like, either mainstream or at least independent comics, but it's really nice. Those are, I mean, those are like a lot of pages too, but I see what you mean about the simplistic text, but, you know, maybe simplistic text and a complicated story go together well, you know, a little yin and yang or whatever.
Yeah, well, I do like his artwork. Sometimes I find he keeps it a little stripped down more than I would like, but
it works. It has that anime style a little bit.
Well, saying all that, I wish I had done them. I mean, it's, when I give criticism to it, it's also it's with envy, because it is nice work and it's consistent. And I do like, it looks very nice in color. But he has done, some of his books are independent. We'll have a link on the blog, and he has a site. And I do know he has the Rosary book, and I want to say he had a short book about the Monkey King, which is something that does interest me. But, again, it seemed to me like they're just kind of thin, small books. And
so he's Catholic?
I think so.
So he's probably seeing it from the Christian perspective as well as the Buddhist, Chinese Buddhist, you know, perspective or whatever, which is a good thing.
Well, like I said, when you read boxes, you're seeing it completely. There's no apologies. You're seeing it completely from the Chinese Buddhist perspective.
And then the other side will be the Chinese European.
Right. Which I think is genius. I do like that.
Is that what that movie, I can't think of the name of the movie, that one about the Last Emperor is about?
Oh, The Last Emperor. No, that was basically, it was just that. It was about the Last Emperor. It's about how life was in China, and then it shows the communists.
Oh, so it was way after the
World War II occurs during it. It's basically the story of the Last Emperor and what happens to him and how he ends up becoming a gardener at the end of the movie.
yeah, right.
It's a strong movie.
Yeah, definitely. It kind of like, I thought the Boxer Rebellion was like in the 1800s or 1700s or something.
I think
like
it was at the end of the 1800s and beginning of the 1900s, right?
It was turn of the century. Okay.
Wow. Which makes sense that, you know, change occurs during there. You know, it's one thing that's always been lacking with me. I remember when I was in high school, we were taking state history, which I didn't enjoy that much. And then after that, it was American history, which I did enjoy. And I saw a senior student with a book that said world history. And I was so intimidated but excited, because on the cover, it has, you know, these Babylonian drawings of people. It has ancient Chinese emperors, which I knew nothing about any of the Asian countries whatsoever. I couldn't distinguish between China and Japan, which is stupid to say now, but to me, it was all Asian, and it was all one place. I guess to me, it's almost like if you speak Spanish, you're from Mexico, which is nonsense, because you could be from a lot of places.
Yeah, a lot of places.
But if you didn't know, you know.
But it originates in Spain.
Exactly, but
except they have that lisp, which we don't.
Well, you know, like I said, is you live among people that speak Spanish, and you start finding out where they're from, you find out they're just as distinct apart from each other, even though the Spanish is different.
Yeah.
It's the same thing. Come to find out, the world history I took didn't tell us too much about Asia.
Yeah, so, if I remember correctly, when I was in school, the world history talked a lot more about ancient Greek and stuff like that.
Which I enjoyed immensely. That stuff was great, too, but I know almost nothing about South America's history.
Conquistadors. And
well, yeah, but I guess the one thing I always make a joke about is Bolivia.
The Spanish.
Bolivia doesn't sound like a country that would be in South America. It sounds like a European. And then I found out from a friend of mine from Colombia, you know, I found out it was a General Bolivar.
Yeah.
Who was a liberator, which I'm guessing in football they have a Copa Libertadores, like Cup of the Liberator. I'm guessing maybe that's supposed to be Bolivar.
Yeah.
And like I said, I found out, I guess he was the one that did something and split Colombia into three separate countries.
Oh, okay.
You know, Colombia was three countries. Now it's three of them. Colombian. I'm butchering. World history wasn't very good in Oklahoma.
Well, I mean, we may have studied it, but it's been so long
in my case. I never knew it. And so whenever I get a chance to find anything about China's vast, rich history or, you know, Japan, any of that stuff, I just gravitate to it. And it's like just scratching the surface on it.
Yeah, the Spanish countries are all Indians, basically, that were converted into Catholics by the Spaniards, and they're going out to sea and conquesting and, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Well, that happened here as well, in the United States, was happening. But, you know,
Mexico.
I guess it's one thing. There was a woman we worked with, an older lady, who she used to be a middle school English teacher, which I find unfathomable. As a matter of fact, she proofread Dallas's book. I can't remember the name of it. It's linked to the sidebar of our blog.
The Circle?
The Circle Theory. Circle Theory.
Yeah.
But
which is connected to the Mighty Blue.
The Mighty Blue, yeah. I think Mighty Blue is a prelude to it, a prequel. But every once in a while she'd bring me a book to read, and a lot of times I'd be in the middle of something else, and it wasn't a book I wanted to read or I would have chose myself. After reading it, I realized that was the book I should be reading. And once she brought it to me, she found that it worked. It was the Poisonwood Bible. You know, so I started reading it. It was basically about a family that went from one of the southern states in the United States to the Congo in Africa as missionaries. It was a man and wife and their three daughters. And I wasn't enjoying it. I didn't like the missionary. I felt bad for the wife. The girls, you know, what they were going through in the Congo, basically the Congo was just immense, great poverty.
Sure. Still is.
Yeah, well, it's something everybody knows. It's a rough place, it's a dangerous place, and the people are dirt poor. And as soon as they get there, the people in the Congo had a big celebration for them. They had a big stew, you know, a big, huge pot, and everybody's wearing their best, and it's a big celebration. They're singing. And then the missionary just gets so upset, and he gets up, and he just lambasts them because all the women are walking around without tops, which was their way of life. And all of a sudden, they were ashamed, and they covered up and ran away. And then the girls were saying, it looks like the people went hungry. You know, they didn't eat what. And this is the food. As an American's going there, the food was kind of sparse and not that good. But as the story evolved, you found out that basically they were giving them their best. Well, their whole perspective starts changing as they're in the Congo for a while. And later they find out, before the Europeans came, the Congo was plenty. People had plenty of everything. And he says, what was happening was you just walked a certain way to get, you know, your produce, get your food, but there's enough food for everybody, and that's just how they live. And so what happened when the Europeans came in, they saw that, and they just thought, well, this isn't efficient. And what they were basically trying to do was the whole collective farming, you know, where you grow everything and make everything in one part, transport it to another part, and sell it. And so they completely changed the whole way of life, the whole system of everything, and it wouldn't work in the Congo, and that's why the Congo has been basically just devoid of everything ever since.
Mm.
But, you know, if you read that, that's what wiped out the Indians. It's what wiped, you know, here in the United States. What worked in Europe didn't work everywhere else.
Yeah.
You know, and whenever you read history, after World War II, the United States was so scared of communism, and they were going and building factories in these third world countries, which was a bad fit. They, what they should have done is, you know, set up education. So you had all these people being treated really bad in these factories, you know, basically slave labor. So anyway, reading the Boxer's Rebellion, that sounds to me it's kind of the same thing. Europeans went into Europe, I mean, into China, not understanding it, thinking we knew everything and messing it up.
Well, I have to say that I'm still scared of communism, so. Coming from one of those countries myself.
You know, I never realized that, you and another friend we worked at, his parents left a communist rule. I never thought about that. Well,
it's bad news, man. But, you know, let's not get into politics or anything.
Well, I'm not.
Like
but, you know, one thing I will say, when I was in the Navy. Of course, the Navy was just completely against communism and stuff. But if you actually read what communism is supposed to be, it's the same as Christianity. You help each other out. You share your resources and stuff.
Yeah, but if you read about communism, they don't believe in religion.
Well, I got you. But at the same time, ideal communism is basically the same thing Jesus Christ was teaching. But real communism is not.
Karl Marx was full of shit. And we'll just leave it at that. Let's play some songs. What do you want to play, Don?
Alright, this is a band that I'm embarrassed. I don't know exactly how they pronounce the name, but they're from Japan, and I think it's called Kuma.
Yeah.
Now, who was that? Whatever
it was, that was Kuhn. I think it's Kuhn. I don't know the Japanese.
K-U-H-N?
C-U-N-N-E. C-U-N-E.
Okay.
Right. I say Kuhn. Anyway, as you can tell, they're really good, and I like them.
All right. Sounds good, man. What's that? Okay, let's talk about that book, because I remember the Silent Invasion comic books back in the days. They were in the 90s, but I'd never read them.
Well, there was two books in, I guess it was the 80s, and called Silent Suburban Nightmares is one of them.
Yeah.
And the other one was Silent Invasion. It was from Renegade Press, which used to be
our... Oh, yeah, Denny Lubert, yeah.
The story of that was there was... Aardvark Vanaheim, which published Cerebus, and yeah. I guess they had some other books, and then the couple split. And Denny Lubert, you know, had Renegade Press. I don't really remember. I guess they did Fish Police. Was that one of theirs?
Yeah, they did. They almost did a book that I was going to draw, but today she backed out at the last minute.
Really?
Yeah, we had years ago, a friend of mine did we did a book called Delta Wave, and it finally came out through some small publisher, but she was interested in it, and then I guess for some reason or another, she just kind of like backed out at the last minute. But they did. See, if you would have told me in advance, I would have researched that they did a lot. They did some. There were black and white books, Renegade Press. I seem to remember there was a book they did, because a romance book. And it had stories by the Hernandez brothers, and even had an Al Williamson story, and it even had, like, what was it? And maybe, I can't remember what the other artist was, but yeah. Oh, she did that other one, too. Oh, God, I can't remember right now. But yeah, anyways, they were an offshoot of Aardvark Vanaheim.
Now, I remember they had a lot of books. I can't think of any one I've read, but I do remember the advertisers for them. I saw her at a Tampa Con in 88. I was talking to Michael Kaluta, and I was showing him my work, and then she said, she was sitting next to me. And he says, "Hey, Denny," and showed me. She ended up giving me information on many comics. And she was real nice. She was showing me some of the work they were planning on publishing. One was a guy that, I guess he was some type of insurance investigator, but when I was just telling the story, I said, it looked kind of neat, though. The artwork was neat. And I said, it reminds me of Buzz Sawyer. You know, when he was the investigator for the oil company? She goes, yes. I guess I would say it would be similar to early Buzz Sawyer. And I mean, it was nothing like Buzz Sawyer, but that was the synopsis.
Yeah, yeah.
She was taking chances. It wasn't like she was just trying to be another...
No. This was during the black and white era, late 80s.
Silent Invasion, I never picked the books up, but I didn't know they did Suburban Nightmares. It was by Michael Shirkus and Larry Hancock, and they also did Silent Invasion. I kind of liked the looks of the books, I just never picked them up. Anyway, a comic store I went to, they had these two trades, Silent Invasion Book 1, Secret Affairs, and Book 2, Red Shadows. So, you know, I picked it up, I liked the look of it. And the guy that ran the store said, "Yeah, those are neat. He just got them in." So I picked them up, and I'm embarrassed to say I must have got them in 93, and I've never read them. I pulled them out once in a while, said, "I need to read these," and I just couldn't get started. So anyway, this last week, I pulled it out, and I read through them. For some bizarre reason, the first few pages, it just doesn't enhance my reading experience. If you read through it, it gets better. Frank Miller did the foreword for the first one, and Max Allen Collins did the foreword for the second one. There is a story to it. There's all kinds of stuff and different characters going on. You know, it's one of those conspiracy theory type things. It's based in the 50s. I think it's Larry Hancock is the artist. He's certainly got a...
Michael Chirkus.
I think he's the writer.
No, it says Michael Chirkus artwork. Where is it?
Yeah. Oh, you got Michael Chirkus listed first. Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
But he can draw. He's got a design sense. I do like how he draws cars and buildings. And he's got a very stylized 50 thing where everybody's got big bodies and small heads. You know, it's kind of fun. My only complaint with the artwork is I don't like his finishes. It looks to me like he uses a brush for everything, including the word balloons. but and he has control with the brush. It's not sloppy brush work, but I would have liked to seen a little bit more pen work on it. But that's just me. But I liked it, but I didn't love it. I thought these two books finished the whole story. It didn't. But it's got flying saucers in it, and you're basically talking about the main protagonist in the story is investigating flying saucers. The whole Red Scare is going on.
Yeah, I see that.
And he's basically smeared, and he remembers something happened in Albany. And people are disappearing. The building he lives in, there's a Russian that he doesn't trust, and he's always saying, the paper says, we're looking at Reds, we're not worried about, UFOs. The FBI is after him. And at the end of the second book, I realized it continued on. I started looking it up, and I guess there's several graphic novels, and they've just released them again in the past few years. I guess it's been out of print. I have to say, I'm not going to go look them up, but...
But you liked it enough to reread it.
Yeah, I mean, for some people, I'm sure it would be fantastic. And I do remember Suburban Nightmares that they read. Again, I would have liked it better if somebody else would have come in and finished his work. And when I say that...
You would have liked it better in color, I'm thinking.
Well, I don't mind the black and white, but I would have enjoyed more depth. And again, the guy has the control for the brush, but it's just too, if it's all brush, it just wasn't really...
Well, he's trying to capture that kind of 50s look of cartoony 50s.
I'm guessing both of these men are in advertising.
Yeah, well, now you mention that, it gives me a topic to talk about. What did you think about the black and white books that were coming out in the late 80s? I don't know if we talked about this before. We might have touched on it, but that was where a lot of cool people got there.
Oh, yeah. Well, you didn't think I read black and white books. I did. I guess I never really thought.
Well, you had to back then if you were in a comic shop. Mm-hmm. They were everywhere.
Well, because I still remember,
Talking about the 80s boom, mm-hmm. not the creepies and eeries and all that stuff.
Well, I like Star Reach when that came out.
Yeah,
that's
right. That was a nice book, yeah.
And then ElfQuest came out in, 78? And I liked that. I picked up Cerebus from time to time. I guess I never thought about it a whole lot.
Because the Turtles came out of that?
Yeah, I never read the Turtles. Yeah, the Turtles, I think, is what really increased
that's what
that
started it, yeah.
But Love and Rockets, I absolutely
Love and Rockets, yeah.
And then Fantagraphics did a bunch of those books. Lloyd Llewellyn by Dan Clowes.
Yeah.
Who my daughter, I've learned, is a huge fan of now. She loves Ghost World.
Yeah.
She just bought a Dan Clowes
hardback. 8-Ball, I think, was a book that
he had. Yeah, I had a couple of those. But she had, she picked up a book called Death Ray by Dan Clowes.
I saw that at the Barnes & Noble.
And she says, I really like Dan Clowes a lot. But,
he's kind of like, he's got a great style, but his stuff can be kind of, unnerving at times.
Well, she said it seems like he tries to make everything uncomfortable, which so I...
Yeah.
But his drawing style changed from Lloyd Llewellyn. He had the same 50s kind of graphic style that they seem to be trying to do on Silent Invasion.
I
like Dan Clowes' way of doing it better. But then he changed it. When he went on to 8-Ball and Ghost World, it's the Dan Clowes style you see now.
Yeah, Hate was another black and white Peter Bag,
First it was it the first one Peter Bag had Neat Stuff.
Neat Stuff, which is a magazine.
Yeah, well, that was. I always thought that those Fantagraphics comic magazines they did would have done really well in record stores.
Yeah.
I used to always say that they should sell them by the cash register because Love and Rockets was huge and
it was rock and roll. It was punk, yeah.
But Lloyd Llewellyn, there was another one they had called Threat. It was
I never
guys.
Read that one, but
I did. I had a few of the issues. I really liked the Holo Brothers. Those guys did. One guy did, and Bob Violence was another. There was four different guys.
Okay.
And but I really enjoyed those. They had like six different books. Jim Woodring. He had a book called Jim.
Jim, I remember that.
And then he had Frank.
Yeah.
Which was unique. There were black and white books. There was a bunch. Usagi Jimbo, which I've read ever since.
Retief.
Yeah, Retief.
Mad Dog, that was John Strnad.
See, Retief, the same creative team did Dalgoda, which was in color and I loved.
Yeah, Dan Sweetitaki was on that one.
Yeah, whatever.
Yeah, I was going to say that, too. There was another artist, kind of like, and had a nice style from the 70s, but he was mostly in fanzines, and I don't think he ever did too many comic books. His name was Robert Klein, not the comedian Robert Klein. Do you remember an artist called Robert Klein?
No.
He was a fanzine artist, and he was a very nice artist, but he never really hit with any kind of mainstream comics. I think he ended up becoming an animator for one of the companies over there in California. But he was another guy that just kind of disappeared. I found like an old magazine of Skywalk, one of those Screams or Nightmares, and those had Dennis Fujitaki stories. But back in the early days, he was doing like a Jeff Jones kind of thing.
Yeah. I loved him. I'd seen his work in fanzines and stuff, and I remember James Donat was at a convention in Dallas in 82, and he mentioned Dalgoda, and he said there was one page that Dennis Fujitaki sent him in on ship, about a ship, and he says it must have taken him days to draw. Well, it was fantastic. It was one of the beginning of Dalgoda, one of my favorite comics. He also did, I think he had a graphic novel Eclipse put out called... I can't remember the name. He had a dragon. There's a story about a dragon. He had like three stories in it. They were early work.
Okay.
But then, like I said, Dalgoda, Retief is the only comics work that I really know of. I think he did a couple of short stories in Usagi Jimbo, like backup stories. He did, it was in the Fantagraphics book or something. He did a backup story in, he did three-issue backup story in some comic book somebody put out. Anything Goes or something. It was about
I remember Anything Goes, yeah. It was like an anthology book or something.
I'm not sure
like
if it was Anything Goes. It
George
was,
Perez did one of those.
Yeah. But it was a three-part backup story about a guy that was, I guess he was some type of investigator. He was worked behind the desk. But it was neat. I mean, but Dennis Fujitaki drew it. I don't know who wrote that.
I don't either. It's a while ago, and it probably hasn't been reprinted either.
No, it was in
The Hernandez brothers, I think, did work in Anything Goes.
Yeah, well, I don't think it was Anything Goes. I think it was during that time, though. Because Fantagraphics was putting out a bunch of books because of the lawsuit against Fleischer. And that's when
yeah, the Michael Fleischer thing.
Because I know, Dalgoda, when they did 8 issues as Dalgoda.
That was Mad Dog Graphics, I think.
Yeah, that was Fantagraphics.
Oh, it was Fantagraphics? That was Mad Dog.
And then after 8 issues, they brought it back, I guess it's Mad Dog, and it was called Flesh and Bones. It was the last
version. That's right, that's right, that's right.
And they had Alan Moore's Bo Jeffrey Sacker.
That's right.
But it was one of these books. I guess it was, I don't know if it was Fantagraphics or it was Mad Dog. But Dennis Fujitaki drew a three-story backup in something. I don't know which one of these titles. But, yeah, very little work. I know he worked for a TV station in Hawaii. So maybe he just went into that. God, he was greatness.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's a lot of these guys just kind of, like, never really got, but they ended up getting work in other, whatever happened to Ralph Reese. Remember his work back from the day? He was kind of like a... He worked for Wood, started having a call of a Wally Wood style, but then he kind of like changed his style and became like more of a pen and ink, a lot of detail or whatever. Really nice artist. Man, I haven't seen. He used to do a strip for National Epic called One Day Affair or My Affair or whatever. It was kind of like a takeoff on a soap opera. Yeah, he's another one. He also did a book that I have here. It's a Sherlock Holmes graphic novel, but it's one of the early ones, like from the late 70s, early 80s, and it's beautifully drawn. That was another guy that I haven't seen his work. We'll post it on the page or whatever, but I haven't seen his work in a long, long time. There's Ralph Reese. There was Fujitaki. There was Robert Klein. There's a couple of other ones. Well, actually, I wrote here about guys that, from on my blog, Destination Nightmare, I've been doing a lot of... 50s comics.
Yeah.
And there's artists that I've been finding that worked in the 50s. Maybe one of them worked in the early 60s. But they just never, for one reason or another, never transitioned into the Silver Age, which is what we remember the most.
Right, right.
And there's three guys that I've seen their work, and they're on my blog. Louis Zansky's one guy, Jim McLaughlin is another guy, and Emil Gershwin is the third guy. These guys started out like in the early 50s. I think they worked through late 60s. But I'm just wondering whether a lot of these guys from back then just kind of quit the business after the Comics Code thing and, got work in advertising. I know Bill Everett quit and he worked in advertising and he came back. And there's a few other ones like that. It's kind of like a hidden time in comics. We know a lot about the Silver Age. But those guys in the 50s and Golden Age, sometimes it gets a little I know there's an author that my friends actually met, and he has a list, an Atlas Timely list on Yahoo Groups or whatever, and his name is Mike Vassilo, and he's doing a book on Atlas Comics. So that might be a source of I'll have to find that book, which I think is coming out soon, to find out about these people. But yeah, the more I post these stories on it, the more I'm finding all these good artists had never made the transition to the Silver Age. And plus, I wrote down here artists that were actually started out as Golden Age artists, and I had no clue because all I ever remember was seeing stuff in the 60s from them. Jim Mooney, Jack Sparling, Gene Colan started, and he had EC work from the early 50s, and Bob Ochsner, who did all those... Bob Hope and Jerry Lewis, he was a Golden Age guy too,
and Supergirl.
Well, both Mooney and Ochsner did Supergirl, yeah. And these guys were Golden Age artists that worked in that style. It's funny how, like, in the 50s, everything changed and guys kind of, even, I guess Murphy Anderson was a Golden Age artist, but he always looked to me like a Golden Age artist, He always had that style that look back to the late 40s stuff or whatever.
Yeah, I guess so. I do know a lot of these guys went into advertising.
Lou Fine went into advertising, too. The guy who did all the Golden Age of Ray and all that.
It seemed to me like, at the time, and there were some exceptions, but if you went to advertising, that's all you did. The only time I think of somebody that didn't is like Bill Everett when he came back.
Right.
But who was it? Neil Adams and Dick Giordano started
Continuity,
but they continued to do comics while they had the advertising agency. And I know Walt Simonson worked for them. And Walt Simonson did the Grand Funk album, Shining On?
Shining On, yeah, he did the graphics for that, yeah.
And I was surprised. Cause
that was Continuity Studios.
That's one of my favorite albums. And I was reading about it on Facebook, and he said that basically they had the deal to do it, and nobody wanted to. So Walt Simonson took it and put it together with the 3D glasses on the cover.
Oh, yeah, I remember that, yeah.
But
that's the one that has Locomotion, right?
Yeah, I think it does.
Yeah.
But I don't know. It seemed to me like Gil Kane was in Comics Journal. I guess it was before he died, and he was talking about his life, and to me it sounded like he was really bitter and regretted working in comics all this time. And he was talking about going to parties and meeting all these people in advertising and all these long conversations they had, and he said he was always wishing he could go into advertising.
Yeah, they were probably like, the advertising guys were probably like social butterflies, going to cocktail parties and...
Oh yeah, well there was they hired a guy where we work at that was a creative director. He used to worked for ABC Television, and he also was the art director for Popeye's Fried Chicken. Joe Oriolo and Ben Sagendorf taught him how to draw Popeye. I've got one of his Popeye's.
Joe Oriolo was Felix the Cat, wasn't he?
Casper. He created Casper.
That's right, yeah.
Well, he created Casper, and I guess he redesigned Felix the Cat.
Right, from the early guy, yeah.
But this guy, he was a really good artist, but boy, he was a social creature. When he came in, he was just very congenial, talked to everybody. I always thought, man, this guy would do really well at parties.
Yeah.
And whenever he walked, he would just talk. And, some people resented the fact because I guess they wanted a job. And he could he could present things and talk and just, you know, I went to meetings with him and stuff, and he was always the center, you know. It takes a bit of that, but I don't know. I just remember Gil Kane, who I loved dearly, his work, and he was always wishing he got an advertising instead of a comic.
His style didn't lend itself to it in a way. It was too, you know, when you had somebody that was more decorative or whatever, it lends itself to advertising.
Well, I think his early work he did in the 50s and 60s, it did lend. I think he just,
yeah, he did. He changed.
Well, it's like Jack Kirby. He just started getting more stylized with the comic industry, which, again, I love, but
anyway. Even though Jack Kirby did do work for the humor magazines and stuff like that, my friend, I forgot which one we were talking about, that, but he has a humor magazine, like one of those mad ripoffs, and it has Kirby illustrations in it, so he tried his hand in it, too.
I'll tell you, you know, you always find something else out about Jack Kirby.
Yeah.
I was listening to an interview with the guy Morrow, John Morrow from
Tomorrow's, yeah.
Yeah, and they did the Kirby Collector. But he was just talking about, he's been doing it for 20 years, and he's still finding artwork or finding a story nobody knew about. Remember when Kirby first went to D.C. and he had those two magazines they were supposed to put out? One was about the mob, and, you know, it's a big, giant, oversized magazine, and the other one was supposed to be the Spirit World or something. I guess never came out. I saw one of them at the store.
Yeah, those things. It was Tales of the Mob and Spirit World.
And I think Tales of the Mob did come out, but Spirit World never did.
No, it did.
Well, they reprinted it.
Oh, now. They reprinted it, yeah, or something. But I have a Spirit World comic book, yeah. A magazine.
But that's what the guy interviewing said, never heard of it. And the guy was saying he's been publishing that Kirby Collector for 20 years.
Tomorrow's never heard of Spirit World?
No, the guy interviewing Tomorrow.
Oh, okay.
But he said, I'm still finding new things about Jack Kirby that nobody knew. Like, I guess the humor thing would be one of them. He did a lot of stuff. He didn't talk a lot, but he drew a lot. He told a lot of stories through drawings.
Well, yeah, I mean, he was back when Mike. I was having a discussion with a friend of mine, and you would actually know better because you have a better memory than I do, about the whole thing with the. With the Atlas, when they let go of a lot of artists because of the inventory, when Martin Goodman, what years were those? And was Kirby one of the guys that was let go? Do you remember from the Untold Story of Marvel Comics?
No, I always get that kind of confused.
Was Kirby let go?
I think him and Simon were let go. Remember the Stan Lee thing?
From Atlas, Marvel, or whatever.
Yeah, because they were doing work for...
That's right, because they were doing work for another company at the same time.
They had a hotel room at the lunch break. They were going over and doing... Because that's what Joe Simon said, we can get a lot of work. Everybody's farming, Victor Fox and everybody else.
Yeah.
So that's what they were doing, was going over to the hotel room and doing work. And then we
But that wasn't for down. Atlas, though.
It might have been Timely.
That was Timely.
I don't know if they really did work for Atlas.
I thought Kirby did do some work for Atlas. Well, I mean, he came back and did all those I Am Gru from. He did that stuff, and that was Atlas stuff.
Okay, well, he came back at one point, but I think a lot of that he was gone.
Well, there is a story in there where it was like Martin Goodman saw the inventory they had, and he just fired everybody and basically said, we're just going to publish anyway. We were trying to figure out what years those were. It had to have been like 56, 57, somewhere around there, 58. And then what was the time frame between that and when Kirby came back and you know, did the Fantastic Four?
That Marvel book.
I gave it back to you. I don't have it anymore.
No, not that one, but that Marvel, the museum and the book.
Oh, yeah.
That would have that, because it has the information about Timely and Atlas and what years they were.
You mean the Marvel Archive thing or whatever?
Yeah, that big, giant, awkward book.
I'll have to look through it or whatever. But, you know, okay, we're digressing now, because I thought you remembered from reading the book or
No, I don't.
Yeah, because there were some, like, lost years there or whatever, you know, when, like...
Yeah, they talked all about it in the Untold Story about how... they had all that inventory work that Stan was taking, and they were just constantly publishing that work for a long time. And then finally Jack Kirby came back.
And then not the Silver Age started, but the Marvel era started or whatever.
Yeah.
But I'm thinking that he came back to Marvel and was doing those giant monster things. him and Ditko were doing them, and when they came back or whatever, and then they were just like working there, freelancing or whatever when the superhero thing hit. It's all in that book, man. I thought you would have remembered, but okay.
Sorry, I let you down, man.
Yeah, you let me down, man. Sorry, people out there in listener land. We'll have to reread the book again and like give you the exact. So, you got anything else, or should we just hit it?
Well, I guess it's hit it, but I just didn't want to mention that.
Well, there you got another book there.
Well, that's good to see. Brandon Graham, I talked about him recently. Multiple Warheads, my daughter's a fan.
Oh, yeah, that's what Multiple Warheads is.
Which I got to be a huge fan of. But she got another trade called King City, which I guess is a bunch of comics he did in the past. It's black and white. I'll tell you, this guy, he's certainly a world builder. He does things that just is bizarre and wild, and the story just flows. This is earlier work, but I just started reading it this morning, and I can't put the thing down. In this case, the guy comes back to King City. He's been gone for 2 years. He's carrying a cat in a bucket, and he says it's a copycat. And so the cat can do anything. And he sneaks in this building, breaks the lock. There's a key. He has a belt with a bunch of syringes on it, and he injects the cat with some serum. The cat takes the key, puts in his mouth, and makes a copy. He leaves the regular key there and takes the copy with him. And the cat can do anything. At one point, he's using the cat as a periscope. He's looking for the cat's butt, and has the cat open his mouth, and it's just bizarre, but the cat can do anything. And it's certainly unique. I'm kind of fascinated with the guy because I really like his stories, and he has a fluid pen. He puts a lot of stuff in it. And my daughter read that Multiple Warheads is basically, he was basing it off Russia. Never being in Russia, I never would have thought that. But Multiple Warheads is fantastic. I found out they're going to put his 4 issues, he just did, into a trade with also, I guess, the first Multiple Warhead story and a couple other stories. And what gets me is it started out as a porn comic, it says.
So a porno?
It just says a porn comic. I don't know how.
Is this in the foreword or something like
no,
that?
No, it's on Image is putting out the complete Multiple Warheads, I guess like that one. But they said it started from a porn comic, which will be in it. But he's really unique. I looked him up. He's got a really nice blog. And one thing he was talking about was that, remember Nelvana, that animation company from the 80s, late 70s, 80s? They used to do a Star Wars cartoon about the droids, you know, R2-D2 and C-3PO. I never watched it. I saw part of it. I remember Stuart Copeland did the soundtrack for it, drummer for the Police. And he loved the cartoon growing up, and he said that basically the creators of the cartoon was trying to adapt Mobius' airtight garage into it. And he said it was a cartoon he loved dearly. But I see a lot of... The guy is certainly his own man. He was a graffiti artist. But I can see a lot of Mobius work in it. He's got a fluid. He changes right and left. He's got all kinds of stuff going on. He's absolutely a unique character, a creator.
Yeah, it looks nice. I mean, it's kind of, again, it's put up by somebody called Tokyo Pop or something.
Well, it says Tokyo Pop, but it's an Image book.
Okay, so Tokyo Pop Presents.
Okay. Yeah, I don't know exactly how that works.
Yeah, Image is the publisher.
But, you know, this is a black and white, square-bound, phone book-looking book, and I'll tell you, it's early work, but it's fantastic. It's unique.
So it looks good. I mean, is that the one you're talking about that your daughter bought in Tallahassee?
Well, that's one of them.
Oh, there's more of these.
Well, Multiple Warheads is the other series. I showed that to you, the comic.
This isn't Multiple Warheads. This is just called King City. Okay, same characters?
I know.
Oh, okay.
But it looks to me like the same world. I mean, you know.
I see what you mean. Yeah. Different story in the same world that he created.
Well, I was wondering if this character shows up in Multiple Warheads, but I don't think he has. Like I said, I read maybe a quarter of the way into it.
This is another big book here. It looks like about 400 pages or something like that. It's a lot of work in here.
But it's he's a really clever designer. Like if you look at the cover, it's 4-color, and even the inside covers. When you open up the front inside cover, there's a flap.
Yeah, I see it, and it's
pull it back.
Yeah.
It's a girl on the toilet, and she's saying something to close the flap.
That is kind of funny.
It's just, I don't know, great fun. I love this guy. I can't recommend him enough. And like I said, it's not like you have to hunt down a bunch of single issues. You can get one really nice, big, thick book. And my daughter got the single issues of Multiple Warheads. I was going to try to find them myself, but I guess in late December they're going to put out the complete, which I'm buying.
Okay.
I'll find out about the earlier work. So anyway, that's all I got.
Man, that's a lot of graphic noveling you got here. You are Mr. Graphic Novels.
Yeah.
Where I'm becoming Mr. 50s pre-code horror. But yeah, well, one other guy that I want to talk about, because I've been finding his work. He didn't do a lot. But the guy who did the Erie Publications, Myron Fast, I keep finding, like, stories that he did in the 50s, like horror stories. It's funny, because he's not, like, a great artist, but he was really, like, effective in his kind of, like, style or whatever, you know. And I keep finding these stories, and I'm fascinated with them, because it's kind of, you know those artists that are kind of borderline? They're, like, kind of good, but not great, you know what I mean? He's kind of one of them, you know, and they kind of have that 50s style, and you wonder if he had stuck around a little longer, it would have gotten a lot better, you know. It's odd. I'll show you some examples of it or whatever, but obviously it makes sense that he published these books, as he was, like, you know, very good at these, like, gross, like, 50s horror stories that they put out, like EC-like things or whatever.
Every publication, just to get straight, that's not part of the Warren stuff.
No, that's Witch's Tale and Horror Tale. Those are those cheesy horror magazines that came out in the 60s with the horribly lurid covers of gross and, you know, reprints of 50s comic books or whatever. Here, there's a book here called The Weird World of Eerie Publications that I have here.
I think you've shown it to me before. The reason I brought it up was on your last podcast on Destination Nightmare. You and
Chris C.K. and Brian.
And Brian Yetter were talking about, and you kept bringing up the Erie publication.
Now, these things are, like, they amaze me, and, like, they're, like, bizarreness or whatever. But when you go back and you look at all the 50s pre-code horror, it was disgusting, a lot of them. You know, it was, like, zombies and heads chopped off and the whole nine yards. And it's just like a 60s B-movie or whatever. So if you like that stuff. But Fast was a decent enough artist, and he did a lot of work for Marvel and Atlas, which was surprising too. So it's very interesting going back into that era and finding stuff and seeing what you can find. So anyway, well, I guess we got nothing left, so we might as well just end this extravaganza of comic bookness.
Who are you taking us out with?
I'm not going to tell you, but it's going to refer to something that we talked about in this. So we'll just leave you at that. And do we have to talk about clicking on Cyclopses or anything like that?
Yeah, let's do it. Everything we talk about on the blog, you can find, everything we talk about on this episode,
you will find
on the blog. All you have to do is go to bunchdorks.com and
click on the Cyclops.
And that's it.
And then you read more comics.
Oh, that's right.
And then you go to Destination Nightmare and you read more comics there. Then you go to Slow Robot A Go-Go and you, like, get movie reviews. And you won't read any comics there, but you'll find out about these B-movies that some were actually influenced by comic books, believe it or not.
There you go. So, and they're all on the sidebar of our blog.
Yeah, it's the hub of entertainment, as they say. So we'll just leave you with that, and then we'll see you.
Bye. Closing.
Time.